Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White. Happy to have you with us today and happy to have our crew here in the studio. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning.
Ryan.
Good morning.
Bob.
Hello, guys.
Philip.
Hello, guys.
And our special guest today is Dr. Jason Warner, who's our cow-calf specialist here at K-State. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we're happy to have you with us because we had some listener questions, and we thought you would be just the person to help us answer these. So we've got a couple questions that we'll talk through today. One on some of the vertical coordination in the beef industry, another on the frequency of vaccination, and then we'll also talk through how do I manage my operational net returns, and we've got a question in that direction that I'll let you guys throw in your opinions on. Before we get to those, we do really enjoy getting those listener questions, or you can send us feedback. If you want to send us an email at bci@ksu.edu, you can also reach out to us on Facebook or other social media. As those listener questions come in, it's good for us to have an opportunity to discuss some of the things that are affecting you and your operation. So we're always happy to take those. Before we get into our first listener question, guys, I've got a little bit different question for you. I want to know if you had to pick somewhere and you're going to take your family on vacation, but it cannot be a typical vacation spot. So you can't say Disney World, you can't say somewhere like that. Like, where would you take your family that may not be a popular vacation destination?
Do I have to take the family?
Yeah, you gotta take your family, bro.
Oh, kids too?
Yeah.
We're actually talking about taking a trip to Barbados. So beach, yeah. Rum, hang out, yeah.
That sounds like a vacation spot.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid growing up, you know, some of our vacations were, you know, going to the state fair or visiting family and or friends out in Dodge City or something. And as a kid, heck, we're staying in a hotel with a pool. So life is good. It doesn't really matter where you are.
Exactly.
So I, honestly, as when your family is young, you can really take them almost anywhere. There's anything.
You could take them to a palace made out of corn say, look, it's pretty cool.
Oh, you know,
we've been there.
We've been there too.
There you go.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think the boys and I like to go, probably just to go west and go through a bunch of the state or national parks and do that kind of stuff. I would like to go up to the Northeast too. I've never been up that way and just the history and go through like a history tour, history of up in the Northeast, and that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, you and I maybe better go together because I've tried to get my family to go on some of those history tours. They're not super excited about that. Dustin?
So I think I'd probably agree with Brian. Probably head south somewhere so we got beaches, do some deep sea fishing, golfing, and then head up into the mountains and maybe do some, you know, ATVs and stuff like that.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Jason?
So I'm going to give a plug in for the Kansas Department of Travel and Tourism because we're going to be the odd family out and we're going to go check out the Tallgrass Prairie Reserve because we've not been down there to see that yet. Oh. And I know they would love it. So, yep,
yeah, that'd be perfect. Yeah, there's lots of things you can do in Kansas. Bob has a whole list of Kansas fun facts on the wall in his office. So all the tourist sites. Can you name off other tourist sites in Kansas?
You can go. Yeah, you can go out to the Castle Rock. You can hit
Geographic Center of the U.S. Biggest course. Ball of twine. There's a whole biggest list of things you can go see. Largest hand dug well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's
is it Bruto?
Oh yeah. Bruto,
what's the giant excavator?
Big Brutus.
Oh, Big Brutus. Oh,
yeah, that's actually pretty. Which big. I've not checked out.
Oh, I have.
I see a lot about
it's
it.
Big.
Yeah.
You go up and go, holy smokes, it is big.
Listen, guys, we don't want all these people coming to Kansas all summer. It's going to be packed here. So.
Yeah.
Let's start out with this first listener question. I think it's a really good one, and this has gone back and forth. And the question is, what about some of the vertically coordinated beef supply chains that are using data to bring value from conception or genetics all the way to consumption or the retailer and consumer? And there's several of these examples in the industry. And I guess I'd ask you guys, and Dustin, I'm going to start with you. Maybe a little bit of background on some of these different vertical alliances.
So yeah, when I read that question, is you know, I started to think, why do we do this, right? We think consumer preferences. You know, we can adjust to consumer preferences, provide what they want. There's probably some things related to international trade. So again, we're going to probably talk about traceability. Be my guess is part of this answer. And so I started looking up just some statistics, and I got a bunch here, and I won't read all of them off, but some of these, thinking about the history, thinking about efficiency, this is another thing here, but in 1930s, thinking just from an efficiency standpoint, they spent roughly 25 hours, you know, preparing, processing broilers, 100 broilers. You compare that to the 1980s, it's only 0.2 hours. And so thinking about the poultry industry, they're highly vertically integrated, let's say compared to the beef industry. The pork industry is following suit. But during 1955 to 1980, the real chicken meat price fell by about 54% during this integration. Pork prices fell by 14%. Beef prices actually increased by 18% during that same time frame. So just from an efficiency standpoint, thinking about cost and stuff, I think that's one thing we want to think about.
Which, Dustin, that's a great point, is a lot of times you're thinking, well, if we're all the way through the chain, we're going to get better prices, more prices. But what you're saying is the price to consumers might actually drop because we've increased efficiency.
Yep, and so that was the retail price that I was talking about. So consumers do, you know, maybe they purchase more as a result of that.
Yep, increased demand.
Yep.
Yeah, I think there's some opportunities and some challenges with the beef supply chain, partly just due to the number of producers, you know, the number of cow-calf producers in the country. And if you develop a supply chain, you want it to be kind of different than others, but you want a large enough supply chain to capture some of the consumer market and to keep the product flow coming along. And so there's some real logistic challenges, particularly because our animals are spend most of their time out on grass in relatively small herds. Even a large herd is relatively small compared to the amount of beef you need through a supply chain. But I think there's some real opportunities here. I think if consumers follow with their dollars what they say, you know, they want some traceability, they want some assurance of animal welfare, maybe even greenhouse gases. And if we keep the records and they're willing to pay for that and that value gets pushed down the chain, I think that's a win. But those are some ifs that have to take place for it to really be sustainable and useful to the beef, to the cow-calf producer.
Jason, you travel around Kansas and beyond, and I know you work with a lot of different cow-calf producers. From a cow-calf perspective, do you see more people adopting, participating in some of these vertical alliances, and why or why not?
I think over time we'll continue to see more interest in these types of programs really starting to develop. Ultimately, at the end of the day, exactly, the value has to get back to those producers. And you know, historically, those producers, if you just sell calves right at the end point of weaning at that time period, any decisions that you have made from the standpoint of genetics and trying to add value to that animal during that time period, it ends at that stage of production. And so if there is value that truly gets funneled all the way back down to the chain, absolutely, there's opportunity there. It just has to continue to be there. Otherwise, it stops at that point.
So I think that's a great point, especially with the genetics. Those cattle, by the time they get to weaning, have not, hopefully, expressed their full genetic potential. And if I sell them at that point, I don't get to capture that value of the genetics. And I think it ties into multiple areas, including some of the sustainability. And Philip, I know you've been involved in some sustainability things. Where do you see these vertical alliances? Is that a totally separate line of thought than sustainability, or are they related?
I think they're related. I mean, from the sustainability angle, data is absolutely critical. And that not just, okay, what genetics did I use, but how did I manage those animals? Because for the sustainability angle, especially from the greenhouse gas emissions and some of these larger corporations wanting to calculate their scope 3 emissions, then they've got to know what the management was of those animals throughout the whole production system so that they can accurately estimate that. And so they need data. And so that's where, from a cow-calf or even a feedlot perspective, I can get paid for my data. Essentially, because then those companies have that to do their calculations.
Yeah, absolutely. And Brian, I know there's some thoughts on some of these vertically integrated systems where we may be able to actually manage, if I can communicate between segments of the chain, I may be able to better manage things like health production because of some, and increase some of those efficiencies. What are your thoughts on some of these vertical integrations?
Well, not so much on the health side, but I guess I just kind of had another question is, so how does vertical integration and then what we're seeing with some of the farm to fork kind of direct to consumer marketing, how do those two fit together? Because I think vertical integration, I think, you know, that's a bigger, larger system, and generally the direct to consumer, that's a smaller one. So is there room for both of those, two sides of the same coin?
I would say there would be. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you think about it, it's just a little different form of it. Now all of a sudden, maybe in the direct producer to consumer to marketing channel, now all of a sudden that person is just taking the place of maybe a couple of those other segments of beef production that historically we have. So I think it all fits together. Yeah,
absolutely. So I think great question. We appreciate you asking that. I want to shift gears a little bit, but it's along the same lines of increasing some of our productivity and maybe increasing efficiency. And this question that I want to pose to each of you: how do I decrease costs on my operation without increasing performance?
Well, I'm going to lead with one of the things is, first of all, you kind of need to know what level of performance you are. And so, and what's important to me a lot of times is the breed up, the pregnancy percentage, particularly the pregnancy percentage early in the breeding season. And if that is below really what the target should be for your geographic area, then I think making sure that you reach the level of production that you need, and basically calves wean per cow exposed. And, you know, I think in central Kansas, you ought to be getting a preg percentage of between 90-95%. And that ought to be doable. That's not necessarily doable in all geographic areas, but with our forage base, and we've got a lot of ranches that can accomplish that without getting crazily high with the costs. So you need some base level of production. The costs become really important.
I'm going to follow up on that. You need the base level production, but you also need to track, and you got to know what your costs are. So you need to record that, because it's hard to lower costs if you don't know what your costs are. And I think when you think about the cost, if you look at, you know, let's say the Kansas Farm Management data set, you know, feed costs are one of your largest expenses. And so from there, I even break that down into maybe purchased feed versus homegrown feed versus pasture expenses. And so each one of those, I think you can think through, is there a way I can possibly decrease those costs? And so we'll just take grazing as an example. Do you have a grazing management plan? You know, that would be one step. And then if so, how often do you update it? You know, do you soil test? Do you need to put on various fertilizers, et cetera? What's your stocking rates? Is that the same across each pasture? Is it different during when prices are different, cattle prices, calf prices are different during droughts, et cetera? So I think those are all the things, like, just pick a category and just think through all the various components of each one.
To both of your points, one thing that I really think of when I think about just decreasing costs when it comes to feed costs, as you mentioned, that's a real high percentage of the overall total cost of the operation. But doing things like managing shrink, so when you get into those feeding situations, regardless of whether it's for calves or for cows, managing shrink and just measuring that and putting a dollar figure to that is important. Feed costs are $1.50 a cow a day, 10%, 15 cents, that adds up over time, right?
So when you talk about shrink, maybe say a little bit more. What do you mean?
It can be feed shrink in terms of harvested forages, even commodities that you might purchase, how you manage and store those, additional costs that you might have if you overfeed on certain loads, spilling ingredients, those types of things. A lot of those fundamental things that can they're sources where costs can come in that you may not see.
And often it's hidden, but basically shrink is the difference between what I bought and what I
exactly
used or sold.
Right, exactly. So. Yep.
I think I'm going to disagree with Bob a little bit, and I think maximum performance is not necessarily the goal. I mean, we think about reproduction. There's a certain percentage of cows that will get bred, you know, at body condition score 4, 4.5, rather than 5. And so problem is, I don't know which individual cows those are, so I feed the whole herd. So I think there's a plan, or needs to be a plan, or think through the process of what is my cost per unit of whatever output. And it may not be maximal performance. It may be 85 to 90% pregnancy rates. It may be depending on where I'm at and what my feed costs are and to do that. So I need to think more about, well, I have to meet a certain level of performance. No, I need to minimize the cost per unit of whatever output.
Just unit cost of production. Yep, absolutely.
Which really comes back to knowing what's my performance, what's my dollars in, and what are my dollars out, and figuring out where the low-hanging fruit is. Is it to increase performance, or is it to decrease cost, or is it a little bit of both, that maybe I can get by with less performance and even greater less cost? And really, but you got to have some records to do that. So I'm looking at Dustin, that's what he would say.
Well, and that's what you, when you've looked at that Kansas farm management data, Dustin, that's what you've seen is there's not huge differences on some of the performance side, but there are differences on the cost side.
And that's where most of it is. It comes back to the cost side between your high performers and your low performers.
Absolutely. Well, appreciate you guys' thoughts on that. And I want to jump into our next topic. And this was another good listener question. Sometimes we get into habits of doing things and this is the way we do them and you don't question it. I like the idea of questioning maybe how we do it all the time could not be right. And in this case, the listener said, hey, tell me about how useful is it to annually vaccinate the entire adult cow herd? I know that there are differences in herd size, differences in areas, but there's always a cost of vaccination. We got to run them through the chute. We've got to get the cows up. Is there always a benefit? Brian, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's a great question. We always talk about, you know, when you're talking about vaccination programs, talk to your veterinarian because it should be individualized to whatever disease challenges that you have in your herd. But I think this question gets to another part of why vaccination programs are individual is because the producers have different levels of risk tolerance. And when we talk about vaccinations, that's what we're really getting after is, you know, what's your tolerance? Are you willing to accept a 2% mortality to offset the cost of not vaccinating, not just the vaccines, but the labor? You know, is that what level of risk you're willing to accept? And I, one of the challenges we have with vaccines is we don't know what the challenge, if we knew what the challenge was going to be, we'd just go in and we'd vaccinate for it and we'd be good, right? But we don't. And so oftentimes we're using these as a risk management strategy.
I kind of look at it, there's kind of a science part of this question, and then there's the practical application part of it. In that, so one of the ways I interpreted this question was, do you mean to tell me that cows are susceptible 1 year after we gave them a vaccine and that it's absolutely essential that we booster that 1 year later in order to keep their immunity high? And for older, mature cows that have been vaccinated a few times, I think that's not true, that a cow isn't all of a sudden susceptible a year after her last vaccine. We probably have protection that extends well beyond a year. Again, and I'm thinking of older, mature cows. They've got a mature immune system. They've been vaccinated a few times. But then you say, okay, so technically, we wouldn't need to vaccinate mature cows every year. Well, that becomes logistically a challenge. It's because with my younger animals, probably annual vaccinations for the first couple of years is very helpful. And so it's just easier to treat the whole herd as one group, with the younger animals probably benefiting much more from those first couple of annual boosters than the mature cows. But it's just easier to manage them as a group.
Well, I'm going to push back on you a little bit. So, yes, mature cows are less susceptible to disease, but there are, and you said, well, they're going to have immunity and it's not going to go away. And if they had, it's going to last longer than a year. Not for all the pathogens, not for everything that we're concerned about, even everything in vaccines.
That's true, too. And there's some real differences between individual viruses and differences just between viruses and bacteria and how they respond to vaccines. So I think I'm pretty comfortable with my statement as a overarching, but you could find some bacteria that would not be true. And so,
well, in some bacteria that it would be true. I mean, it's not just so you think of clostridials or things like that. We know they stimulate long-term immunity. Things like lepto, the immunity doesn't last as long, whereas our viruses may be different, but some of it too depends on, I'm going to go back to what Brian said, how well was the program designed and implemented? So giving a single vaccine at the wrong time, or it may not even last a year. But if I do it well and I've got the immune system primed, it could last longer. Jason, I want to turn to you and ask, what do you see in the field? Do you see people, because to me it seems like annual vaccines are pretty common. Do you see people doing it annually or more or less often? What do you see?
I would say it's very wide range. There's a lot of cowherds out there that from my experience will never see a vaccination. And there's some that are certainly a lot more intense than that may do annual vaccinations on cows, but there are a lot of cows out there in the country that will never receive one.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge that you guys mentioned is we don't know the exposure side of the equation. So we can talk about managing immunity, but there are operations that have very different levels of exposure. How does that play into this discussion?
Well, and the exposures, I mean, we're talking about exposure to the environment with clostridial, so that would be probably fairly consistent year to year. And there might be some things with drought or soil disruption that might increase or decrease risk a little bit. But, you know, in the scenario that Bob gave was a group of mature cows. But if you have animals coming in and out, so even think about bull. I mean, you're purchasing bulls, you're bringing new animals in. It changes those exposure, or that changes that exposure risk. And so it probably should change how you think about vaccination a little bit if you have a closed herd of mature cows versus where you're bringing animals in, or they're younger animals into your herd, or mixed populations within your herd. All of that changes, and that's why it's really important to have that discussion with somebody, veterinarian, that they can help you walk through not just the science technical aspects of these are the pathogens, this is what you need, this is the immunity, but also have that discussion about what's your personal level of risk. Because quite honestly, if you lose an animal or you lose some pregnancies because of reproductive losses, you could have paid for an awful lot of vaccine.
Yeah. So what's your level of risk and what's your risk tolerance, right? And how you want to handle that risk, because people handle it different ways. But I like the biosecurity approach. I've heard the analogy that vaccines are kind of like insurance. Would you guys agree or disagree with that?
I was going to say it's more the problem with the insurance analogy is the insurance doesn't actually prevent fires or floods. It just pays you if it happens. I think it's more like a fire retardant drywall in that it actually should provide some protection against an insult. And let's say fire protection, fire resistant drywall is quite a bit more expensive than regular drywall. And so it's a cost to put that in place, and you hope you never need it. But you hope that if there's
And you for sure don't need it every year.
And you right? sure don't need it every year. But you put it in and you keep it there. You don't take it out when you think the risk is getting less. So I think it's analogous to some of the things we do to actually fire suppress, not just pay us if something bad happens.
So and in this case with vaccines, just to be clear, we've bounced around a little bit talking about different pathogens, and I brought that up. But mostly we're concerned in mature cows about preventing abortions. So it's managing that reproductive side. And those abortions, for most pathogens that we're talking about, don't occur at just a low level year after year after year.
It's either zero or I notice it.
Yeah, it's zero or it's bad. Yeah. And so similar to the fire analogy is you may go lots of years without having a fire, and then you have a fire and your prevention was needed. But you don't know when that's going to occur, which is why you want to manage that immunity year after year. So as summary in answer to this question, I'm going to go back and pin you guys down and say, are you saying yes or no, vaccinate annually?
I think it's just easier to vaccinate annually. Technically, the biology doesn't insist upon that, but from a practical standpoint, but I'm going to vaccinate annually.
But for some pathogens, it does if they're my primary concern. So to Brian's point, if I'm designing a vaccine program to manage this pathogen versus another, I may need to have different frequency.
Yeah, I think that might be a middle ground approach if you're willing to pay attention to the details that maybe every cow needs a vaccine annually, but every cow doesn't need every vaccine annually. So I don't know. Again, logistically, I'm with Bob. It's easier just to do everybody all the time, but I think there might be some other strategies to work around that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I appreciate you guys answering these questions, and we had great listener questions today. If you have further listener questions for us, you can send those to us at bci@ksu.edu. And I want to thank Dr. Jason Warner for joining us today. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks. Appreciate it.